Good morning. My name is Lynn, and I'll be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the press call on the high price of local immigration enforcement. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you, Ms. Angela Kelly with the Center for American Progress. You may begin your conference.
Thank you, and thanks everyone for joining us this morning. My name is Angela Kelly, and I'm the Vice President for Immigration Policy and Advocacy at the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. On today's call, we're going to be discussing two papers. The first is entitled When Mr. Kobach Comes to Town, Nativist Laws and the Communities They Damage. It was prepared by the Southern Poverty Law Center. The SPLC is a nonprofit organization that combats hate, intolerance, and discrimination through education and litigation. And the next paper we'll be discussing is by the Center for American Progress, Unconstitutional and Costly, the High Price of Local Law Immigration, Local Immigration Enforcement. Both of these papers examine anti-immigrant initiatives and from different perspectives reach very similar conclusions about the outcomes of these kinds of initiatives, and I think serve as an important warning to jurisdictions that are maybe considering similar initiatives in the future. So we'll be hearing in just a moment from the paper's authors and from an elected official from Prince William County. But to set the frame for today's discussion, it's noteworthy that there are pending over a dozen proposals in state houses and probably scores of proposals related to immigration enforcement in local communities. The vast majority are about enforcement, and these proposals are frankly born out of frustration with the federal government's failure to fix our broken immigration system. There's anxiety that people feel, and they feel that they must do something, and hence they often turn to these types of proposals. But as you read the two papers and you hear the authors speak today, there's three themes that really emerge that I'd like folks to keep their eye on. They frankly should be a flashing red light to any lawmakers that are considering similar initiatives. The first is that measures like these will bust your bank account. That though the places that are profiled in the two papers are as different as New Jersey and Nebraska, that the damage to the bottom line is the same, that jurisdictions will spend substantial sums of money to pursue proposals that are in most cases going to lose in the courts. The second theme that emerges is that these ordinances are bad for business. It's consistent in that in each and every case, the jurisdictions have been badly impacted, the business climate has suffered. In Riverside, New Jersey, for example, 45% of businesses closed in the aftermath of their ordinance. And the third theme to emerge is that people notice the company you keep, that the Latino community, the immigrant community, feels targeted by these measures, and it isn't the case that all undocumented people live in an apartment building and they'll simply move out if you pass an anti-immigrant initiative. And in fact, there has been substantial damage done in each of these communities to the relationship with the Latino and immigrant community that will take years if it can ever be repaired. And related to that, in terms of the company you keep, SPLC will go into some detail describing the gentleman who is behind these initiatives and the types of organizations that he's related to. So let me turn to the speakers. Our first speaker is Jibby Martinez. Jibby is a senior writer and policy analyst for the Center for American Progress. She's a former Washington-based journalist and political analyst. After Jibby, we'll speak Prince William Supervisor Frank Principi. Supervisor Principi was elected in 2007. Prince William County is in Virginia and has been very much at the eye of the storm and has been perhaps the most studied of anti-immigrant initiatives. After Frank, Mark Potok, the director of the Intelligence Report of the Southern Poverty Law Center, will speak, followed by his colleague Heidi Byrick, the director of research for the Southern Poverty Law Center. But let's first turn to Jibby. Jibby?
Hi, thanks, Angie. First of all, just to set the stage here, I wanted to remind all of us of what we're all familiar with, which is Arizona. We know that the first court ruling has gone against most of SB 1070 and the implementation has been delayed. But we also, at CAP, studied the economic loss, which is projected to be $253 million in lost economic output, plus $86 million in lost wages over the next 2 to 3 years. But before Arizona, there were five local jurisdictions that we're studying in today's report. that show the dire consequences of turning bad politics and sound bites into even worse policy. So I'm going to go through real quickly the five that we've studied to give you some highlights from each of these jurisdictions. The first one is Hazleton, Pennsylvania, which is the leader in the court fights for local immigration enforcement. And we know that it's in the tank for at least $2.8 million, but there are also a couple of estimates that say it could be as high as $5 million. And they vowed to defend their ordinance all the way to the Supreme Court, so we know that those costs are going to rise. You know, at the beginning, the city tried to tell its voters that they were going to get the insurance carrier to pay for the legal bills. And when the insurance carrier declined, they took him to court. And in fact, the court has said that the city is responsible for those fees. So they are going to have to dish out more money than they anticipated. The next city was Riverside, New Jersey, which suffered a local economic downturn before the city realized the error of its ways, and it rescinded its anti-immigration ordinance, and it actually welcomed the return of the immigrants, which in the past had been Brazilian immigrants and had actually been a very key part of their economy. And then we have Farmers Branch, Texas, which is very much like Hazleton in that it has already spent $4 million in legal fees and is expected to spend at least $5 million to defend its anti-immigration statute. And there is no end in sight. You know, this lawsuit could have been avoided. The former city manager advised the council not to proceed, but to wait for Hazleton to litigate this and to let Hazleton spend its money on this. But Mayor Tim O'Hare said that he wasn't ready to throw in the towel, and the lawsuit is now pending before the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. The interesting thing is that Mayor O'Hare has already announced that he's not going to be running for re-election, so he's going to leave this problem in their hands. The next one is Prince William County, Virginia, which dramatically scaled back its initial tough immigration statute after realized that the original version would cost millions to enforce and to defend in court. And it was the police chief there in Prince William who really steered them away from that initial ordinance, citing not only the liability that could come from lawsuits, but also the difficulty and the cost on the police department to enforce this. So there was a very strong law enforcement voice that spoke out in that area. The final one is Fremont, Nebraska, which increased its city's property tax to help pay for the legal fees. And it's going to defend its ordinance also in court. You know, the backstory about this one is that the city council decided it didn't want to do this, but the voters gathered petitions to get it on a ballot, and they were forced by a court to hold the election and then to enact this ordinance. And I would say that, you know, they were agitated by people like Chris Kobach, who you'll hear more from in a few minutes. So just to wrap up, you know, I want to emphasize what Angie said, that this costly action has other local governments now taking notice because they realize that the cheap political sound bites can come at a huge expense to the taxpayers, the local businesses, and the town's reputations. And a couple of examples of cities that have decided not to do this are, you know, Somerville, South Carolina, and also Tomball, Texas, near Houston. And there in South Carolina, one of the council members said, quote, "I just cannot, with a good conscience, risk potentially spending millions in taxpayers' dollars just to make a point." And with that, I'll turn it back over to Angie.
Thank you, Jibby. I just got an email that the supervisor has been delayed, and I'm not sure he'll be able to join us. So why don't we move on to our next speaker, Mark Potok, the director of the Intelligence Report at the Southern Poverty Law Center. Mark?
Yeah, well, thanks for introducing us, and thanks, everybody, for listening. You know, I just want to say a couple of things to kind of set this report or these reports in some kind of context. You know, over the last 10 years, we have seen this kind of anti-immigrant movement, if it can be described as a movement, growing and becoming more and more heated. I think the rhetoric has clearly gotten uglier and uglier to the point where we, you know, have the governor of Arizona suggesting that headless bodies are littering the state and that this may in some way be related to immigrants and immigration. You know, we've seen a kind of explosion in vigilante-type groups, Minutemen groups, some 350 of them in the last 4 or 5 years. We have seen the kind of anti-Latino rhetoric I referenced, you know, on major television networks, news shows, talk radio, and so on. We've seen a real spike in hate crimes against Latinos, at least for several of the last few years. And that spike has included really horrifying murders like those in Suffolk County, New York, on Long Island, another similar murder by a group of teens in Shenandoah, Pennsylvania, and most recently the murder of a man and his 9-year-old daughter in Aravaca, Arizona, allegedly by an anti-immigrant vigilante, a woman and her confederates. You know, as all of this has heated up, of course, we've seen the failure, the repeated failure of immigration, comprehensive immigration reform over the last few years. So as Angie suggested at the beginning, there's been a great big gap left out there. And into this gap have stepped the leaders of many frustrated communities that don't know how to deal with the changes, demographic and otherwise, that they're seeing. And very often these leaders are acting for very bad reasons because they think there will be some kind of political payoff in it for them and so on. And that has been the case in a number of instances. In any event, the laws we're talking about really begin in early 2006 when San Bernardino, California, considers one of these ordinances. They wind up choosing the better path and decide not to pursue it. But what immediately follows San Bernardino's experiment are the towns, well, some of the towns that Jibby mentioned, Hazleton, Pennsylvania, Valley Park, Missouri, Farmers Branch, Texas, and Fremont, Nebraska. Those are the towns, along with Arizona, that we look at in our own report, which is much more focused on Chris Kobach. Kobach is, or has been for many years, going back about 6 years, the senior counsel to the Immigration Reform Law Institute. He's now just changed that title, so he's merely of counsel to this organization. But he's in a very tight relationship with them. The Immigration Reform Law Institute is the legal arm of the Federation for American Immigration Reform, a very unpleasant nativist group that my colleague Heidi will talk about in a little while. In any event, these are the people to whom many of these towns are flocking in order to help them pass these anti-immigrant ordinances, and they should not. It is a trail of tears they will be following. The truth is that Chris Kobach is a Pied Piper for troubled towns, and he will lead them over a cliff of race relations, of the economy, of the finances of these cities, that will really be destructive. We've seen it time and again in these communities. I won't go through the money that Jibby outlined so well already, but looking at the social consequences of Mr. Kobach and Early's work in these towns, we see things like in Fremont, activists receiving mail, hate mail promising to shed blood, quote unquote, to take back the town. They've had rocks thrown through the windows of their homes. Both the council president and the mayor in Fremont were threatened via anonymous letters. In Hazleton, as Jibby suggested already, the downtown is practically wrecked. It looks like a ghost town. Latino landlords there report being threatened. A particularly remarkable story was the story of a publisher of a Spanish language newspaper who went as an impartial observer to go and report on a pro-ordinance rally near City Hall, where he was surrounded by residents of the town yelling "traitor" and "get out of the country" at him. So this was quite typical of the kinds of racial divisions that these ordinances, which will not succeed ultimately in court, are causing. In Farmers Branch, we have more remarkable stories. The librarian there reporting being told by a city official that she had made the library, quote, too welcoming, unquote, to Latinos. One councilman wrote in an email that we talk about in our report about how the library should remove all foreign language materials, that what they should be doing in that town is encouraging the use of English and only English. In the case of Farmers Branch, they've had to outsource the library completely. They've had to cut personnel and special events budgets already. So it has been a real trail of tears for these towns. And the truth is that at the end of the day, These are not even good faith attempts to pass ordinances or other laws regulating immigration. Michael Heckman, who is the leader of EARLI, the Immigration Reform Law Institute, actually at one point described quite candidly his view of these local ordinances as, quote, field tests, unquote. In other words, EARLI and Chris Kobach are merely carrying out social experiments in the hope that maybe one of these laws words will stick, but certainly also with the realization that these kinds of ordinances have stirred up an immense amount of trouble in these communities and presumably will lead to some kind of growing pressure, white nationalist pressure, to force some kind of change in immigration policy in this country. You know, the reality is that though Michael Heckman and EARLI sees these laws as field tests, many residents of the towns that have lived through these disastrous events feel much more like the survivors of crude medical experiments. I mentioned very briefly sort of the motivations that we see in FAIR and the Immigration Reform Law Institute. I'd like to turn it over to Heidi Byrith, my colleague, who has done a great deal of work on FAIR, on its founder, John Tanton, and its leader, Dan Stein.
Hi, everyone. Thank you, Angie, for putting together this call. I just want to talk for a few minutes about what the Federation for American Immigration Reform is really all about. We've listed the group as a hate group since 2007, and although on its face, FAIR often presents sort of a veneer of legitimacy to the world, its leaders have testified in Congress and so forth, the real goal behind the organization is, frankly, a nasty one, and that has been to rip apart the 1965 Immigration and Nationality Act, which ended decades of racist immigration policy in this country. In fact, when Lyndon Johnson signed the act in 1965, he said straight up that this was about ending an era of prejudice. Well, for Dan Stein, who was the president of FAIR, that era of prejudice, he doesn't agree with that. He sees the 1965 act as having been a mistake and having caused chaos, and also having been a form of revenge, that's quote, against Anglo-Saxons that was basically propelled by people like Ted Kennedy. So frankly, when FAIR is engaged in these efforts that roil these communities and when they're engaged in their field tests, what they really do is this is a cynical attempt to build a movement that advances their agenda to end this policy of having brown-skinned and darker-skinned people allowed into this country under our immigration policies. If you look at what FAIR claims it wants to do, which is just simply reduce immigration down to levels of about 200,000 folks a year admitted into the U.S., and that it has nothing to do with the racial nature of those folks, that's what the public face of FAIR is. In private, what you hear is that the founder of FAIR, a guy named John Tanton, talking about the fact that America needs a Euro-American majority. You hear about the fact that the founder of TARE, John Tanton, also at one point wanted to create an organization to defend the interests of European Americans. That face, that racist face, is one that's kept quiet and in the background at FAIR, but it's the one that's really driving what the organization is up to. I'll just give you a couple other examples of FAIR's hateful, all the reasons that we've actually, frankly, list FAIR as a hate group. President Dan Stein has done things like accuse immigrants of competitive breeding. He said that immigrants hate Americans. Many of them hate Americans. The organization has taken money from the Racist Pioneer Fund, which was literally set up to improve the breeding stock of white folks in the United States. They celebrate the fund to this day on their webpage. They've hired people who are connected to hate groups. They have members of their board of advisors who write for hate groups. And they've produced programming that's all this is laid out in the report that basically talks about the reasons why this country needs to be peopled by white people and not dark-skinned people. So that's the basis of us listing FAIR as a hate group. And that's the agenda that's driving Chris Kobach and FAIR to conduct these, to push these policies in communities that are just suffering as a result of it.
Thanks, Heidi. I don't think that we've been joined by Prince William Supervisor Frank Principi. So why don't we get instructions on how folks can line up for asking questions? So, operator, could you tell people how to do that?
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Your first question comes from Gary Martin.
Hey, Angie and Jibby, my question is this. There's a lot of legislatures that are looking at state bills as they get going here this year. A lot of them want to duplicate what happened in Arizona. But to that extent, it's more or less that police should not be able to ask identification or immigration status of people that they apprehend. But we do have secure communities that's being run by the administration, and that is where they enter. If they do get picked up, they enter their information into a database that ICE is allowed to look at and deport. So just how do you guys rectify the differences there?
Sure. I'll take a crack at that, and others can jump in. So you're right, Gary, that Secure Communities is a program that DHS is very aggressively pursuing with a number of jurisdictions that, as you said, when police come in contact with people, they can, you know, basically run fingerprints and immigration checks on them. It's an extension, frankly, of the 287G program that was started now many years ago, where there were memorandums of understanding that were reached between local jurisdictions and DHS so that in different ways local police could enforce immigration laws. And there are certainly concerns that people have with secure communities and how it's implemented. The stated objective of the administration of DHS is to really go after people who are the worst of the worst, who've got criminal records, who are committing serious crimes, but many people on the ground are reporting that there are often, people with a broken taillight and, you know, that sort of just much more minor interaction with the police, which, of course, the concern there is that it makes people afraid to interact with the police, and communities find themselves where they're very hesitant to call the police to report a crime, something that they've seen, something that they've been a victim of. And I really think that's kind of at the crux of any relationship that you form with local police and immigration authority, is that you're dealing with people whose lives are, you know, they're like everybody else's, right? I mean, they try to get themselves to work and their kids to school, and in the course of that, we want them to feel safe and that they'll report what they see that may make the community unsafe. So I think, though, that there is a hunger out there for local police localities, as the reports describe, to do something. And so there may be some ways that police could, after a person's been found guilty, after a person is in custody, that they could then, and they have done this for years, where they look into the person's immigration status, that may not be as harmful to community relations. But I think, you know, kind of however you try to divide up this, you know, however you try to form the relationship with police and immigration enforcement, you have to recognize the impact it's going to have on the community.
Angie, I'd like to add one thing, that if the
sure.
reporters on the call would like to talk to the supervisor afterwards, I'm sure he'll be available. One of the reasons why we wanted to have him on is because he is now involved in helping to carry out the enforcement that they find, the ordinance that they finally did do. And one of the key differences in the ordinance between the first version and the latest was that instead of asking people, you know, for their immigration status when they were stopped for a broken taillight, they now do not check them until they are under physical custody following a criminal offense. Police officers still have the discretion to ask them before that point, but the policy is to wait until they are in physical custody. And that is consistent with, you know, what many other jurisdictions are doing across the country. And as you said, it really did help to reestablish the police community relations with the real people in that county who are having to live under this law. They were very frightened by the initial versions, and it seems like the damage that was done to the police relations is starting to be repaired.
Thanks, Jibby. Folks, I just got word that Supervisor Principi is on the call. Is that correct? Maybe not. Sorry about that.
I'm here.
Are you there, Supervisor?
Yes, I'm here.
Terrific.
Good morning.
Good morning. And we're so happy that you could join us. We've actually gone through the speaker's presentations. I don't know if you just heard the last question, though, and if you might want to answer that and then just make a couple comments. We've also got some reporters that are already in the queue to ask questions, so I don't want to leave them hanging for too long, but would love to hear a few words of wisdom for someone on the front lines.
Sure. And we are at Prince William County on the front lines of addressing the illegal immigration issues. I did not hear the question. I did hear the answer, and I think the answer is probably correct. Many of you may know, the individual who promoted this in 2007 has now taken his illegal immigration ordinance to the state level. And as our General Assembly is currently meeting in the month of January, February, and March, he has asked governor and the House of Delegates and the Senate to adopt the earlier version of the illegal immigration law statewide. He feels that he's got himself a very much a political issue that he can run with, and despite the fear and intimidation that he has caused in our community, he is endeavoring to make that a unfunded mandate statewide here in the Commonwealth of Virginia.
Thank you, Supervisor. Why don't we take a few more questions, and we'll give you a chance to answer them, and that'll also be a way to get your perspective out on the table. Operator, is there another question in the queue?
Your next question comes from Diane Stillis with Dallas.
Hi, I'd like to know if you can give a cost estimate on how much the ordinance has cost in terms of legal defense. That would be for the five communities that you looked at.
Sure. Jibby or Mark, you want to take a crack at that? And Supervisor Principi, if there's anything you want to say about the cost in Prince William, that'd be great.
I think Jibby should go ahead because she looked at five communities as we only looked at four.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, and they're detailed in the report too, Diane. But go ahead, Jibby.
Right. Excuse me, but I didn't hear all of the question because it seemed to be cutting in and out on my earphones. Can you repeat what she was asking?
Cost in the five jurisdictions?
Oh, okay. Yes, what we have is $1 million per year is what Fremont, Nebraska is budgeting just for the beginning of the legal challenge that they're going to make, that they're going to defend against. You know, they know that they're going to get sued for this, and that's what they're budgeting so far. In Hazleton, the cost has been $2.8 million. But there are a couple of estimates that say that it could already have reached $5 million, and we know that it's going to go up more because they're appealing this to the Supreme Court. In Prince William County, and Supervisor, correct me if I'm wrong, but we have a $1.3 million cost initially for the, you know, getting the police force ready to enforce this ordinance, plus about $700,000 per year for the actual operation of it. Riverside, New Jersey, had a very fast $82,000 cost in legal fees. But remember, they pulled out of the legal fight right away. They rescinded their ordinance. But they also had a drop in tax revenue because of the loss of business. And then Farmers Branch, Texas, we have at just under $4 million. And as you know, that this is also going to increase. The case is now on appeal before the Fifth Circuit Court, and we'll wait to see how far they carry that. But those are the costs we have so far.
Great. Supervisor, any additional thoughts on that?
I think we're looking at the cost issue far too narrowly. You know, when you talk about the impact of the cost of administering the ordinance, and that those funds coming out of general revenues, coming out of the police budget. That's a real number. That's taxpayer dollars being spent to implement this, but I think you need to look much, much broader at the total cost of this sort of ordinance on a local community. I mean, just consider this. The UVA study that was done 3 years after it was initially implemented suggested that we had an exodus of thousands of Hispanics, legal and otherwise, out of Prince William County into neighboring Fairfax or Stafford counties. With that exodus, there was the buying power, for example, of these individuals, be it at the grocery store, at the restaurant, you know, down the street at the store. We've lost a significant amount of sales tax revenue. We've lost a significant amount or some amount of income tax revenue. We have lost property tax revenue. You know, when the buying power leaves the community, and the small businesses in my district along Route 1, lose that buying power, lose those consumers, those customers, they close. The home foreclosures were exacerbated. The property taxes that were coming from home values being declining, reduced. So the real cost of this is surely on the general revenue. It's also lost tax revenue, but it's also just as importantly a direct impact, and there's a dollar impact I'm sure someone could come up with on the damage it's done to our community's brand and reputation. I can tell you, even today, there is not a day that doesn't go by when, in my elected capacity, someone doesn't approach me and want to talk about what Prince William County has done on illegal immigration. So that negative impact on brand and reputation plays out, for example, with businesses who choose, for example, perhaps not to expand in Prince William County, or a business who chooses not to come in to that poison and that hate and that fear and intimidation that has been fostered in the community. So the costs, when you think about $1 million here or $700,000 there, that's real cost. But we really need to take the blinders off and understand the far, far wider impact and deeper impact it's going to have on a community to do this sort of thing.
Thank you, Supervisor. It's very helpful. I also neglected to say at the top of the call that this call is being recorded. Do we have any more questions in the queue?
Yes, your next question comes from John Hanna with Associated Press.
My question is, I noticed that the Southern Poverty Law Center is titled When Mr. Kobach Comes to Town. I'm curious where you put him in terms of his role in this, for lack of a better word, movement. Is how important is he to the movement, and where does he now rank on your assessment of people, figures with roughly, I guess you would call them, within hate groups?
Well, you know, we're not associating Chris. We're not calling Chris Kobach a member of a hate group. I mean, you know, his role up to now has been absolutely central. He has been the primary architect of these laws. He has not written every law, but he has been intimately involved not only in the drafting of original laws, but the redrafting of ordinances in a series of attempts to withstand legal challenges. You know, I think what's happening right now is that he's probably becoming somewhat less important because there are so many model ordinances out there that Early and Kobach have helped to draft. So I don't think we're going to see him and Early necessarily as a player in each one of these states and communities where these laws are being proposed. But I do think he's very important in the role he's played up to now. So, you know, what we are doing is trying to warn communities that this is a trail of tears, that this will only result in damage to your community's finances, its race relations, and its reputation.
Sure.
Next question, please.
Your next question comes from Lou Gum with Kawak, Arizona.
Hello, it's Lou Gum from KAWC in Yuma, Arizona. My question is how deeply you looked at some of the costs. Obviously, SB 1070 is a statewide initiative, but it put some burdens on cities and counties. The sheriff down here has talked about not having jail space if the law were actually enforced down here. I'm wondering if there are any plans to look into things like manpower and burdens on local law enforcement, and if there's any assessment of the costs that they face.
Hi, dear Mark. Do you know of any assessments like that?
I don't.
No, and we're not planning anything particular at this moment.
Jibby, you want to mention our paper that we've done on the conference cancellations?
Yes. We talked about it at the top, and CAP did do a study on the economic impact on Arizona as a result of SB 1070, and we know that it was, you know, it's so far been a significant hit, and what we project is that there will be a loss in $253 million in the state's economic output, and also more than $86 million in lost wages over the next 2 to 3 years. So, you know, it's part of that ripple effect that the supervisor was talking about. You enact a law, and it's not just the cost to enforce, but then it also, in this case, in Arizona's case, where they're a very high tourism state, that was impacted by this ordinance. The tourists stopped wanting to come. You had the calls for economic boycott. And these are real dollars that the, you know, hotel and motel lodging association is experiencing, as well as, you know, caterers, contractors, you know, every related cost to a convention feels this hit. And that's why we could also analyze the lost wages to total $86 million in 2 to 3 years.
Thanks very much. Yeah, and just to reiterate that was a very specific look at just conference cancellations, conventions that had already been canceled, and potential losses from future booking declines. But there's obviously a lot more costs that the question suggests. Our next question, please.
Your next question comes from Julia Preston with the New York Times.
This is a question for Supervisor Principi. Is that how you pronounce your name?
Yes.
Yes. As I'm sure you're aware from the experience in your county, there can be considerable support among members of the community for this kind of local ordinance, especially when you have high unemployment and people are very sensitive to what they perceive as being the cost of to government of providing education and services which they believe are going to illegal immigrants. And so I wonder if you could make an assessment, now that you've had a couple of years of experience, in terms of the perception in Prince William County on that cost issue, or the way you're describing the cost. Do you think the voters also see that the cost of the ordinance is or could be greater than the cost that they perceive that county government is incurring by providing services to illegal immigrants?
Great question. Let me first start by saying that because we're in the National Capital Region here, our unemployment rate has been kept artificially very low at about 5%. So we're not seeing the double-digit rates in Prince William, and particularly in Manassas, in the city of Manassas, here in Northern Virginia. Jobs, I don't think, were a driving force for the a small group of individual citizens who, you know, felt like they were fed up with the situation. Quite frankly, I think it was the fact that we saw a wave of Hispanic immigrants move into our community. In fact, Hispanic population doubled in about a 10-year time frame because we were going strong on development and redevelopment of our community. And the developers, the home builders, people who are building the strip malls and that sort of thing, were using Hispanics as, quite frankly, cheap labor. That attracted them into the community. And when the bubble burst, or when recession started, we saw very large numbers of individuals, Hispanics, who had a job and then didn't, had bought a home one way or the other, and now have decided, because of that fear and intimidation, that environment that existed, that they were going to move out of the county. And when they did that, their homes went into foreclosure, okay, or the rentals were no longer being rented. And in the neighborhoods, we saw a significant degradation in the environment, the tall grass, the broken windows, the graffiti on the wall, and home values plummeting as much as 60% here in this community. And I think that was in large measure what drove a couple of individuals to kind of stoke the flames. I mean, we had a blogger here, still exists, that really incited a group of residents, probably fewer than 1,500 to 2,000, in fact, out of a population of 400,000, that really became very vocal and stepped out there. And, of course, we had a couple of elected officials who said, gee, the election's coming up. This is an election issue, and we're going to step in the front of this and drive this.
Do you feel like the way that the county handled this has changed that equation for the voters?
Well, the way the county has addressed it, I mean, can you be more specific?
Well, I'm just, you know, I mean, I take your point. It had to do with the whole housing crisis. But I'm just wondering, you know, we're trying to sort out here these kind of local ordinances, whether or not they would attract support from in communities, you know, and part of that is the sort of cost equation that voters perceive. And do you feel like in Prince William County that your voters are satisfied that the county took the right course?
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
We do an annual citizen satisfaction survey with one of the local universities here. Have been doing it for 20 years. And while 2007 and 2008, we saw the satisfaction numbers dip significantly, and in particular among the Hispanic and African-American communities, we are now beginning to see those trend lines, that citizen satisfaction, begin to increase or go in the, in the other direction.
Mm-hmm.
I still think that there is still a segment of the population who feel that we have not done enough. And, you know, that will play out in the next election coming up in November.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Great, thanks, Julia. Are there any other questions in the queue, operator, or could you remind people how to ask questions, please?
At this time, I would like to remind everyone, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad at this time. At this time, there are no further questions.
All right, terrific. Thanks, everybody. If you do have a question, we can get you in contact with any of the speakers, and just feel free to call my number, 202-441-5589, and I'll put you in touch with any of the speakers. Thanks very much, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
This concludes today's conference. You may now disconnect.